Dusty Linton, others, Jason Wojcicki, J. Michael Hayes, Sean Tricchi, E. Mark Braden, Catherine L. McKnight, Richard Riley, Colton Vogel, Dusty F. Wojcicki, Baker Hostetler, Appellant Counsel, Christine A. Williams, Wyatt D. Barrett Jr., Debbie G. Seidel, J. Buckley Ward IV, Nicholas H. Mueller, Appellant Counsel.
Before you start the clock, let me ask you a question. You have two discrete briefs in this case. Do you plan to have two discrete arguments with two discrete people?
Your Honor, I think what we intend to do is for me to present, for Ms. McKnight to present on behalf of DLS, and then appellees intend to go, and then we will reserve some time for rebuttal collectively.
All right, so one lawyer. One lawyer on each side?
No, I will be arguing on behalf of the senators, and Ms. McKnight will be arguing on behalf.
In your argument in chief?
Correct.
All right, how are you going to divide it?
I will take 12 minutes, then Ms. McKnight will take 12 minutes, and then we will each reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, start the clock.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I am Jason Torchinsky of Fulton Vogel, Josefiak, and Torchinsky on behalf of Senator Edwards, Senator Smith, Senator Saslaw, Senator Colgan, Senator Marsden, and Senator Barker. Virginia legislators have a constitutional right enshrined in Virginia's speech or debate clause to speak freely within the legislative sphere without fear that they will be questioned for their speech in any other place. And Virginia is not alone. Virginia's speech or debate clause is substantially similar to that in the U.S. Constitution and to that of the constitutions of more than 20 other states. And to fulfill the purposes of this constitutional right, courts have interpreted the speech or debate clause broadly and have done so for many years. At a fundamental level, the circuit court erred in interpreting the clause so narrowly. However, when federal criminal claims are brought against state legislators in federal court, the Supreme Court has applied a common law balancing test or a common law privilege and has found that that common law privilege must yield to the federal government's interest in enforcing its criminal statutes. The U.S. Supreme Court consistently in Tenney and in the Supreme Court of Virginia v. Virginia State Bar has applied the common law speech or debate clause privilege to civil suits. The Veselin appellees in the underlying case here brought a state claim in state court whether federal common law interpretations are wholly inapplicable. This was their choice. They brought the wrong claim in the wrong forum to assert the right to trample on the speech or debate clause in the way that they are seeking to invade the speech or debate clause. They want to distract this court from our arguments and try to convince the court that the senators advocate a speech or debate clause proposition that is so broad and expansive that nothing can ever be released from the legislature in the course of the
You said the wrong case in the wrong forum?
Yes. In other words, if they wanted to take advantage of the federal common law cases where federal courts have overridden the common law legislative privilege and allowed discovery of questions into motivations and speech or debate in state legislatures, they should have brought a claim in federal court and brought a federal claim. By bringing a state claim in state court, where the state constitutional privileges or the state speech and debate clause applies, there's no overriding federal interest that allows a court to invade a constitutional the protections of the speech or debate clause that are enshrined in the state constitution. So had they wanted to find a forum where they could apply the Page, Bethune-Hill, Rodriguez balancing tests or other tests that those courts have adopted since they have disclaimed what they call balancing tests, if they wanted to take advantage of any of those various tests that the federal courts have applied in those particular redistricting cases, the reason that those courts have overridden what is an acknowledged federal common law privilege is because there is an overriding federal interest in those cases. When you have a state claim in a state court, there is no overriding federal interest that allows a court to invade the provinces that the speech or debate has. And so that's why we say they brought the wrong claim in the wrong forum if they want to inquire into the deliberative process of the legislature, which is exactly what their subpoena gets to. They want to be able to drag, in my case, senators, into court. They want to examine their documents. They want to examine their communications. They want to then subpoena them for depositions, which they've done with the senator who waived his legislative privilege. And they want to question legislators about the deliberative process. That is something the U.S. Supreme Court has never allowed. Even in criminal cases, like, for example, in U.S. v. Johnson, the Supreme Court even prohibited prosecutors or told prosecutors they were wrong to have inquired into a speech on the Senate floor that was written with people that worked for the savings and loan that was bribing the senator. And the court said, no, that invades the province. And if you look where the court says this is in footnotes 6 through 7 of U.S. v. Johnson, they've got the actual questions that the prosecutors asked, and the Supreme Court said they went too far. They asked questions that invaded the legislative province, and that's exactly what the Vessel and Appellees are seeking to do here. They are seeking to ask a long series of questions that invade the legislative province. Another case I'll point to where the court denied that was U.S. v. Brewster. In U.S. v. Brewster, you had a case where a congressman was being bribed to introduce private legislation. And the court said, you can inquire into the bribe, but you can't inquire into the legislative process. And the Supreme Court has consistently protected the legislative process when people have brought suits against federal legislators or have tried to take depositions or issue subpoenas to federal legislators. Even in cases like Brown and Williamson, where there were stolen documents from a law firm that were delivered to a congressional committee, the court even said no discovery into how those congressional committees obtained the stolen documents. So the U.S. Supreme Court, when you're outside of the federal common law context, when you're applying the speech or debate clause itself, the U.S. Supreme Court has been incredibly protective of the provinces of the legislature. And that's exactly what the Vessel and Appellees are seeking to invade here in a case where they don't have the federal common law privilege that courts have overridden in cases to get at the questions that they want to ask here.
Let's look then at English common law.
Yes.
This provision was added to the Virginia Constitution in 1870.
That is correct.
Prior to 1870, there were no federal cases that speak to the issue that's before us today. Is that correct also?
That's right. The first federal case to address the common law was before the Virginia Constitution had it, you're right, there's not.
Okay.
Because Kilbourn, which was the first U.S. Supreme Court case to address the speech or debate clause, was actually in 1880.
So let's go back to 1870.
Okay.
And the Virginia Supreme Court or the Virginia Constitutional Convention. First of all, they would not have been in a forum like this because it would have been unbearably hot. They would not have been meeting in July, no doubt about
That's
it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But in the spring or the fall, they would have been meeting, and they had no federal cases to deal with. They would have been looking at the United States Constitution provision, which then hearkened back solely to English common law.
That is correct.
Okay. Give us your best argument based upon English common law.
In the English common law cases, the court, remember that the source of legislative privilege, the reason that it existed and was created under English common law, was to protect the legislature from encroachment from the king, right? It was to stop the king from invading what the legislature, what parliament was doing. And so
in its formal sessions, apparently.
Yes, and
when they were speaking and debating.
Right, because their formal sessions, the province of those formal sessions was, and the whole purpose behind their formal sessions was to introduce, debate, and vote on legislation. You don't think I guess we can presume that under English common law, even back in England, when members of parliament left the parliament building, it's presumed that they spoke to others, and there is not a single case from English common law that was cited in any of the U.S. cases that are cited in I think there's a couple of hundred cases cited in the briefs. I didn't see any cases cited I did not research the British common law separate from the U.S. cases, but I didn't see any British common law cases cited.
But that's our, it's well established in Virginia that the English common law moved into our law.
That is correct. And so when you look at the U.S. cases that have interpreted the meaning of the speech or debate clause, they were basing those on the understanding of English common law. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said, essentially based on our understanding of the history and genesis of this clause through English common law, there's nothing that allows the executive, or in this case private litigants, to invade the fundamental core legislating functions of, in that case, Parliament, but in this case, the legislature. And that's exactly what the Vessel and Appellees want to do here. They want to involve this court in deciding whether certain motivations of legislators, whether legislators followed a process that led to legislation, whether the process itself, whether legislators properly considered the matter of redistricting in the process itself of producing the map, in order for this court to make its decision on the merits of the underlying case. And what we're saying is the English Parliament understood, and the English common law understood that the province of the parliament was not to be invaded by the executive or by private litigants, and yet what you have here is private litigants who are seeking to expose to judicial review the exact core legislating functions that the British common law sought to shield from interference from people outside of the legislature. And it's exactly what they're inviting you to do and permit to have happen in this case. And it's exactly what we submit shouldn't be permitted to happen. And again, you know, a lot of the case law that's cited in the briefs gets to the question of whether something's within a core legislative function. For example, a news release, a bribe, all of the various things, you know, whether defamatory speeches that a congressman makes outside of the halls of Congress is protected by the speech or debate clause. That's not what we have here. What we have here is a subpoena that by its terms, the 17 parts of the subpoena, every single one of them gets to or asks questions about core legitimate legislative functions. There's not one portion of their subpoena where they ask for something as narrow and outside the protections of the clause as copies of all of your news releases about redistricting or copies of all of your speeches about redistricting.
So your position is the entirety of everything that's been requested across the board should just be quashed.
Your Honor, I think it is possible for them to craft a subpoena that asks for things that are not subject to legislative privilege, but that's not what they've done here. What they've done here is crafted a subpoena that is so broad that it requires the invasion of legislative privilege in order to satisfy the demands.
So I'm just trying to figure out how this works practically. For example, request number one, all documents and communications related to compactness. So often the way that unfolds in litigation is you develop a privilege log and you fight over what's in and what's out. What you're saying is just quash across the board and then they come back with a more targeted request.
Yes, I think that's the right answer in this case, Your Honor. Because again, you know, judges are used to the traditional privileges where you have a privilege log and where you review documents in camera, but this is not a traditional privilege case. This is a case about the speech or debate clause of the state constitution, which this court said in Story is one of three absolutely privileged areas of the law.
Right, but unlike some say a bribery case or whatever, the underlying lawsuit also is premised on a constitutional provision of compactness. So you have two, in a sense, dueling constitutional provisions, and we're trying to figure out how to mesh the two.
But I think what this court said in Jamerson and in Wilkins is when you're evaluating the underlying constitutional claim, you're looking at whether the map itself was compact. They are essentially asserting a new cause of action in the underlying matter here where they're saying there had to have been a good faith effort towards compactness. And in order to get at our claim that there has to be a good faith effort towards compactness, we have to examine the legislative process itself, not the outcome of the legislative process. The outcome of the legislative process, we agree, is obviously within the province of the court to determine whether it met with the requirements of the Virginia Constitution for compactness.
Well, but is subjective motivation even a legally relevant question in a compactness case?
We think it's not, Your Honor. I mean, we think you can, I mean, the mathematicians and people with PhDs have figured out all kinds of measures of compactness that this court has experienced evaluating in the Wilkins case and in the Jamerson case, and we think that the case really should rely on what the legislation says, not the process of what produced the legislation, and that's what they are asking you to allow them to inquire into, and we believe that that line of inquiry is foreclosed by the speech or debate clause in the state constitution.
Going back to your question, your answer to Justice McCullough's question, what would be a narrowly crafted subpoena request that would meet your understanding of the limits of speech and debate?
Provide copies of all of your press releases about the legislation, about the redistricting legislation. That, we don't believe, would be protected by the legislative privilege. Provide copies of speeches you gave in any forum outside of the legislature about the redistricting process or the legislative maps.
Well,
you know, something like that would be clearly outside of legislative privilege.
That would be outside of any privilege because it was stated or disseminated in public.
That's right.
There's no possible privilege that could ever attach to that.
But that's precisely what takes it outside of the outside of the protections of the speech or debate clause. And with that, I would like, assuming the court doesn't have any other questions for me, I would like to allow counsel for DLS, my colleague Ms. McKnight, to address DLS specifically, and then I would like to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Well, you're already into your rebuttal time. Okay. You may go.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kate McKnight, and I'm here with my colleague Richard Riley from Baker Hostetler. We represent Appellant Division of Legislative Services. I am here today because the lower court erred in finding that communications between legislators and the Division of Legislative Services are not protected under the Speech or Debate Clause of Virginia's Constitution. This is a matter of first impression for this court. Now, while this court has not yet opined on this, plenty of federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have opined on the breadth of the Speech or Debate Clause coming from the federal Constitution. And we believe that the guidance from those cases is not only clear, but consistent in the principles they apply to determine whether an agency such as the Division of Legislative Services and acts it performs are protected by the Speech or Debate Clause. The analysis those courts have applied is when a legislator delegates an act to an agent, and that act was within the legitimate legislative sphere, then that act and communications related to it are protected under the Speech or Debate Clause. Now, appellees have provided no such clarity or such principle to apply to this case. The question then turns on what is the DLS and what kind of services does it provide the legislature? As you know from the briefing, the DLS is created by the Virginia Code. Its job is not only to assist provide research services to legislators at the request of and serving at the pleasure of legislators, but it also drafts bills at the direction of legislators. It answers questions about the constitutionality of proposed bills. It also answers questions
that would be legal advice, would it not? That would be legal advice, would it not? The questions that are asked and answered?
You're correct.
I guess what I'm asking is, how do you draw a line between a legislative privilege and a lawyer-client privilege in this instance?
No, and that is a fair question, Your Honor. Some of the acts, and frankly, the Division of Legislative Services is made up of a number of lawyers who do provide legal advice. What we're focused on here is its role in providing services to the legislature. And a lot of it stems from their role in drafting legislation on behalf of the legislature. They will conduct research into the impact of that legislation on proposed legislation, on existing law, and how the Constitution interplays. To a certain extent, there is interplay between attorney-client privilege and legislative privilege here. But what's at issue here, and if you look at the subpoena issued by appellees to the Division of Legislative Services, not only does it target the legislative process, but the requests are identical to those requests issued to the senators and the delegates in this case. The reason that's critical is that appellees know that the Division of Legislative Services plays this critical role for the legislature. And it makes sense in Virginia why there is an agency like the DLS. We have a part-time legislature that is in session from 6 to 8 weeks per year. There are some representatives who don't have any staff members solely devoted to them. They share staff with others. So in that period of 6 to 8 weeks per year, when legislators are right next door, running around, speaking with constituents, trying to determine issues of importance to the public, in order for them to also be able to draft legislation and determine whether it is compliant with existing laws, compliant with the Constitution, for them to be able to gather the important research and data necessary to determine how to draft those laws, they necessarily have to rely on the DLS. And that way, the DLS's role is not just as providing these services, but also it provides institutional memory to a body that not only is in session for a limited time per year, but which turns over every few years with new elections. I'd like to make one point about the underlying case that's critical here. In a redistricting case, the DLS also provides access to its redistricting mapping software so that any legislator can walk down the hall. It's important to know that the DLS is housed within the General Assembly. It's not some separate and apart agency down the road. They can walk down the hall, go into the DLS, log onto the software, and look at their district, look at what happens when they place certain voting VTDs or voting precincts in or out of their districts, and see the impact on their district on various constitutional and state law requirements, including compactness, including one person, one vote, and other issues you've already heard about today. It would not make sense to require every legislator to pay for a software license for this mapping software, to download it, to train their staff on the mapping software required to determine these redistricting decisions. It makes perfect sense to have this facility housed in the DLS. Now, thank you for bearing with me while I went through the weeds a little bit on what the DLS provides. The reason I did is that the case law is clear, including Gravel from the Supreme Court, including Doe v. McMillan, that where you have a legislator delegating a legislative act, such as drafting law, researching law, determining the law's impact or relationship to other existing laws, where you see a legislator delegate that act to an agent, that agent's acts, legislative acts, are protected by the speech or debate clause. That's Gravel, that's Doe v. McMillan. Doe v. McMillan is a particularly interesting case because there you had a public printer. You don't have an agency housed within Congress that's providing these vital legislative process services. You had a public printer who was found to come under the protection of the speech or debate clause because of what it did. Its act was legislative in nature. And the Supreme Court, when they found that, they held that the speech or debate clause protected that public printer. So we would submit to the court that the DLS is clearly an agent of the legislature when it comes to these legislative acts. And any work it does on behalf of the legislature related to those legislative acts comes under the speech or debate clause protection and cannot be intruded upon by a subpoena such as the one issued by appellees in this matter.
But you would agree if something is public that they could not assert a privilege as to that?
That's correct, Your Honor. If something is public, has already been publicized, for example, the DLS...
I've been in committee meetings where, it's open to the public and someone asks the DLS person, what about this aspect or what about that, and they just give an answer, and it's not necessarily always recorded or the DLS person hands around a memorandum or an amended bill or whatever, and those things, I don't see how you could resist those under speech and debate.
Well, Your Honor, if you can bear with me a moment, because there's oftentimes you hear the term legislative privilege, and there's a danger there. I think as lawyers, when you hear the word privilege, you automatically think of attorney-client privilege. You think of waiver of that privilege by publication. What we're dealing with here is a protection, a constitutional protection from the speech or debate clause that says that a legislator, and then we have Supreme Court case law applying this to aides or agents, such as the DLS, a legislator cannot be intruded upon to answer for work they did as a legislator. They cannot be called to answer to the judiciary. So here, we have an issue of a subpoena seeking to expose the legislative process by targeting a legislative act and the related communications. So it's possible that a legislator made a public speech, and it's possible that the DLS was at a public committee hearing and made a statement there. Could they be asked, did you make this statement? I would submit that yes, that was made in the public. But if they are asked anything beyond that, their role is as acting as an agent to a legislator, and they are within the protection of the speech or debate clause to say, we are not required to answer for that statement, or for those communications outside of the legislature to the judiciary or in response to a subpoena.
So even if, I mean, typically there's a stack of these memos or whatever, and any member of the public can just walk up and grab one, you would say, because it was done to effectuate legislative business, that you can't get it through a subpoena.
You can't, and let me tell you that a specific example here is that the DLS has a website where it publicizes information about electoral districts, that sort of thing. So I don't think you would see the DLS, an agency, try to protect production of that information or, frankly, directing them to an easier place where they can get it, which is the website. But what you will see is a protection of the deliberative process underlying that publication and that information that was disseminated publicly.
Your side of the case is approaching 5 minutes left. You want to reserve it totally and then figure out, stop the clock for just a moment. Do you want to reserve it at this point and decide between the two of you how to use rebuttal, or do you want to keep on going?
Yes, Your Honor, unless there are any further questions from the bench, I'd like to reserve the remaining time.
Any questions? 5 minutes and 27 seconds. Confer with your co-counsel and decide how you're going to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Wyatt Durrett, and I'm here with my colleagues Christine Williams and Nick Mueller, to whom I am very much indebted for the preparation for today's presentation. Let me first assure the court that we chose our forum carefully. We chose to challenge a Virginia constitutional, or not challenge a constitutional provision, but challenge Virginia legislation measured against the Virginia Constitution in a Virginia court. That was very deliberate. We have not diluted that choice by relying on the portion of cases that discuss the federal common law in federal court when applied to legislative privilege. We do cite and rely on Page and Bethune Hill and Lee, three cases decided by Eastern District judges. If you read those cases carefully, you will see that they discuss the constitutional provision first, apply it, and that is what we rely on, and then go on to discuss the common law. We do not rely on that, and I want to discuss that in more detail as I go on, but because that was the focus of the opening presentation, I wanted to put that up front first. I think it is important to look at the history, as Justice Mim suggested, with the English common law. And that is certainly where the privilege originated, to protect the legislature from it being inferior to the king. And there are a lot of cases that discuss that. And if you look at the key cases that both of us discuss, Gravel and Brewster in particular, United States Supreme Court decisions, there are elaborate discussions of the history. And it's discussed in the briefs. What I think is important is that the history for the United States reflects a little bit different focus than the common law of England, because our institutions are a bit different. And the focus here is to avoid or to protect the legislature in comparison to the executive and the judiciary, so that the legislature will not be subject to overweening of power or control or dilution of its function in our three branches of government from the other two. And respectfully, there's not much danger of that in this case and with this legislature. So the admonition that is present in all of the cases that you have to extend the privilege with care when you go beyond a certain point is, I think, of paramount importance. And I want to start, if I might, with the key case of U.S. versus Gravel. That's a case that is discussed widely in our briefs, and it is the case that extended the clause beyond its literal language. Obviously, I think we all know that the clause addresses members in speech or debate in either house. So it addresses a who, a what, and a where. And it's very specific, and by its literal language, limited. Now, the courts, when you see the language about a liberal construction of that clause to effectuate its purpose, what the courts have done is gone beyond that literal language. And we accept that. In Gravel, they extended it to aides. It's been extended to committees. It has never been extended to a state agency, and I'll come to DLS at a later time. But this is the key language from Gravel that I would focus on and suggest that it.
Counsel, you may want to answer this in your subsequent presentation, but as a practical matter, Legislative Services does function as aides for Virginia's legislators. When you think of the work that a legislative aide or a legislative counsel for a committee does at the federal level, Legislative Services provides those sorts of services to state legislators. And in fact, legislative counsel at the General Assembly are employees of the Department of Legislative Services. So from a practical perspective, you're getting into the heart of the legislative process. So again, it might be that you come back to that as you go beyond Gravel, but that's a concern that I have here, and I just wanted to lay it out right now.
Well, and I understand that, Justice Mills, and I will talk about it later, but I'll address it since you've raised it right now. In this particular case, the privilege has been asserted by DLS, and the appellant said in their opening brief that these words: neither the policies nor the constitutional experience expressed in the speech or debate clause justified differentiating DLS from personal legislative assistance, which is sort of the gravamen of your question. We contend that same history and that same analysis does justify differentiating. If you look at Gravel, the reason why they extended it to legislative aides is because they said the legislative aides are, in effect, the alter ego of the legislators. They act only under the direction and control of the legislators. So that linkage is the key to Gravel's extension. We don't think that linkage applies to DLS and makes it an actor capable of asserting the privilege by itself on a blanket basis. Even in the appellant's briefs, they maintain, and we agree, that the privilege belongs to the legislator. And the legislator can assert it individually. But the issue here is whether you bring DLS within the scope of the speech and debate clause and give it the same status as the legislator or the legislator's alter ego with the ability to assert the privilege itself. And we contend that is a very important distinction. What Gravel says is this: legislative acts are not all-encompassing. The heart of the clause is speech or debate in either house. I think no one would disagree with that. Insofar as the clause is construed to reach other matters, they must be an integral part of the deliberative and communicative process by which members participate in committee and house, and it goes on, activities. An integral part of the communicative and deliberative process. Now let's focus, if you will, with me on what is that issue in this case. We conceded and agreed, and the court held, that within the legislative session, that communications between legislators with one another and with their aides were privileged, and that we could not get documents related to those communications within the legislative session. What is that issue before you with respect to the senators? is whether or not that privilege extends to outside third parties. In particular, whether or not paid political consultants, paid from political fundraising, hired by an individual legislator, or communications with constituents, whether those come within the group, whether those communications are an integral part of the legislative process. That is what is at issue in this case. What is not at issue in this case is what will be done with what we learn from the documents that we get if you allow this to proceed. There's obviously going to be a trial at some point. And obviously there are going to be rulings on what is admissible and what isn't admissible. This is a discovery issue. And as several of the cases that we cite and rely on point out, the rule is not ordinarily interpreted to be a rule against non-disclosure. This is disclosure. And whether or not what questions we could ask in a deposition based upon the communications between a legislator and an outside paid consultant or a constituent, that's what this is about. This is not about, within the legislative session, one legislator talking to another. We're interested not in motivation. I doubt that anyone would seriously question the legislator's motivation to draw these districts as favorable to their political side as possible. But that is not the purpose of our inquiry. Our inquiry is to learn what they did.
We know what they did. What they did is they enacted a legislative act that drew the lines where they drew the lines. What more do we need to know to judge whether or not that's compact and contiguous in all the other requirements of the Virginia Constitution?
I'm sorry, Justice Kelsey, but you repeat.
There'll be evidence at trial on the various ways of doing this. Why is it necessary to know whether there's some good faith basis that the legislators chose or didn't choose as alternatives to what they did? We're just looking at what they actually did.
I agree. The Jamerson and the Wilkins case, which are the two cases that are the most informative in terms of trial law, address a fairly debatable standard and address arbitrariness and unreasonableness. And so,
but is that an objective inquiry, or does it go into the subjective motivations or alleged bad faith of the actors?
I don't think it goes into the motivation of the alleged bad faith of the actor. And our terminology of good faith was a alternative to arbitrary and unreasonable. So if you read our pleading, that is the basis upon which we have proceeded. We do not contend that we're entitled to go into the motive and that the motive of the legislator makes a difference as to whether or not the district is constitutional or not. So which we can take that off the table. That is not something that we contend. So it is important, I think, to realize from the cases that this is the task before you, this is a quintessential judicial function to draw the line here about what is integral to the legislative process and what might be part of the legislative process, might be informative for legislators, might be useful, but is not integral to the legislative process. Brewster suggests, and it's an important aspect of the limitations of the cases that have been discussed here, that there has to be caution exercised in not extending the privilege beyond what is necessary to preserve the integrity of the legislative process. So, as you analyze these cases, and as you know from our briefs, we rely on Gravel and Brewster and Bastian in particular, and the three Eastern District of Virginia cases. So let me turn to those and discuss those with you, if I might. Both in Page and Bethune Hill and in Lee, And the first two were decided by Judge Payne and the latter by Magistrate Judge Young. The reasoning process starts out with the recognition that the Virginia speech or debate clause and the federal speech or debate clause are virtually this identical, and that the case law interpreting them does not lends itself, the federal cases that interpret the federal speech or debate clause, not the common law balancing, but the federal speech or debate clause, are useful and analogous and provide guidance to the interpretation of Virginia's speech and debate clause. And in reasoning through this analogy, all three of those decisions accept the proposition that we accepted in this case, that communications during the legislative session among legislators and their aides are protected by the speech and debate clause. The question there, precisely, is the question here. Is it necessary to preserve the integrity of the legislative process to extend that privilege to the paid political consultants or other third parties with whom legislators might communicate? And all three of those cases answered that question, no, it isn't. And part of that rationale was particular to Virginia and the Virginia General Assembly. And the code section that allows funding for the legislature to hire whatever staff or assistance they need that they find is necessary to the legislative process. And as Judge Payne said, particularly in Page and Bethune-Hill, therefore, it seems to follow that if a decision was not made to hire someone within the framework of that section, then that person is not necessary to the conduct of the legislative business. So that's the line drawing. There isn't any real doubt that if a senator or a group of senators decides to hire an outside consultant or they seek advice from a constituent, clearly that is in the nature of what they do. It relates to the legislative process. That is not an issue. The question, and the key question, is where do you draw the line in extending the speech or debate clause? And here, in particular, where we're talking about a discovery, not what can be done with it later, but the discovery process, where, as you know, we have protective orders. We have one in this case that confines things and makes them confidential to the litigation. So we have two competing values that are at risk. Every additional extension that might be made in the speech of today. One is the search for truth. It is obvious that in the context of litigation, any time a privilege is asserted that precludes the litigants from access to documents, it inhibits the search for truth. And so, in dealing with discovery in particular, you should exercise extreme caution as to how far this privilege is extended. Secondly, we live in a democracy. The citizens who elect these legislators have some right to learn what their legislators did. And to the extent that discovery is precluded by the privilege, that element of democracy is impaired. So you have competing values, which is the essence of the line drawing. And
isn't a response to that, well, then we'll just shift the way we do payroll in the future and just get around this bright line of, well, they're not employed and paid, well, now we'll employ and pay them.
Yes, it's becoming funny that came up in one of our prep sessions. And the answer is no. That was one element of the rationale in Bethune-Hill and Page. but it wasn't the only element of the rationale, and it's certainly not the only element of our rationale. We're looking at what is integral to the legislative process.
And the alter ego aspect.
I'm sorry?
The alter ego aspect,
yes,
of the person,
yes,
we're looking at.
Yes. We have a somewhat unusual situation here in that, well, it's not, I guess it's probably not that unusual, but we've got literal language in a constitutional provision that clearly limits it to members. I mean, you can't get around that. But the courts have said that's not practical in the modern world, so we're going to extend it to aides, and we extend it to committees, and we extend it to the hired staff of the committee and the consultant to the committee. So it's had those extensions. But it's all within that alter ego direction context. And so that is the primary rationale, the who pays for it rationale that was utilized in Bethune and Page is an element. It's part of Virginia's legislative structure, but it is not dispositive of how and where you draw the line.
Can I ask you this? Some of the district court cases you rely on are fairly recent. Should we expect to see, do you know where they are in the appellate chain? Should we expect to see further development, persuasive only, of course, but from the Fourth Circuit?
I do not. My understanding is that, I don't know whether Page is over or not. Page is over. Okay. So that's the congressional case. Bethune Hill is still in the Supreme Court. But not on this issue. I think these issues are decided. And Lee, I think, is still in the district court. But that issue has been decided. I mean, we're here in a somewhat unusual posture. As you know, we typically don't get here for discovery disputes. But, I'm not going to go into that because you all know how we got here.
If Senator A co-authors a communication with Senator B to Senator C, do they all have a speech and debate clause privilege?
That's a very good question. I think the answer to that is yes, but I'm not positive. Certainly Senator A does. And if it goes to Senator B within the context of the legislative session where those communications are privileged, I would suggest Senator B may have.
Well, A and B, in my hypothetical, are the co-authors, and C is a recipient. So the question is, do A and B have a privilege? Does C have a privilege? Because the question that I have is, if they have the privilege, does the waiver of one keep another from asserting it?
The privilege clearly belongs there to A and B, and C can't waive it. Your question is, does C have a privilege that he can assert independently, or can A or B waive it?
Right.
In thinking about that, I think C does not have a privilege that he can assert independently to override a waiver by A or B to their communication to him or her. So I think the privilege resides with A and B, and C can't wait.
But the reason why I ask is the next step is this alter ego concept. And I'm wondering if there's a communication between legislative services and a legislator, or vice versa. And legislative services is an alter ego, and reading from Gravel, shall be treated as one. Could legislative services assert a privilege that a legislator has waived?
No.
Why not?
Because the privilege belongs to the legislator.
That's exactly where I was going to go. The idea of the privilege works right into who gets to waive it. And I'm wondering if the construct here ought to be members have privileges. The scope of what is privileged is extended to subject matters that include legislative services and, in their argument, constituents and consultants, etc., and that you divide the concepts into two, but when all is said and done, only a member has a privilege. Is that your argument or not?
Yes, that is exactly the argument. Only the member has the privilege. And with regard to DLS, that is why what they say in their brief, we contend, is inaccurate, because they say There's no difference between the legislative aide and BLS, and since the legislative aide could assert the privilege as the alter ego of the legislator, so can BLS. But ultimately, the legislator can even override his aide. So if communications by legislators with DLS are to be privileged, our contention is a legislator has to assert it. DLS cannot assert it for 140 members of the legislature, some of whom have already waived that privilege in other cases.
So your reading of Gravel would be that even a legislative aide can't waive a privilege.
That's correct. That's correct.
So the whole idea is that when in Gravel they say we agree with the Court of Appeals that for the purpose of construing the privilege, a member and his aide are to be treated as one, but that does not define who has the privilege. It simply defines the scope of the member's privilege.
That is correct. And that leads to two other points that I need to make. In the briefs of the appellant, they spend a fair amount of time arguing that what you look at is the act that is being examined. And if the act is legislative in nature, or maybe they would concede if it fits within the Gravel standard, they would say that that act is then protected by the privilege, that you don't look at the actor. That is not correct. And if you study the cases, and particularly all the ones that they cite in the footnote in which they cite them, every one of those cases presupposes or concludes that the actor is covered by the privilege. If the actor is not covered by the privilege, you don't ever get to look at the act because it doesn't matter. But just because the actor is covered doesn't mean that every act the actor engaged in is protected by the privilege.
But in your analysis, they're not covered by their own privilege. They're covered by the member's privilege.
That's correct. And if you think about it this way, this is the example that we thought of. If I independently draft a piece of legislation just on my own initiative and send it to my representative in the House of Delegates and say, I think this is a good idea, you ought to introduce it. And he or she communicates back to me and says, yes, I will, I agree with you, or no, I won't. What I did is quintessentially a legislative act. But I did it on my own. And as an actor, I'm not covered by the privilege. So it's a two-part inquiry. Now, and the other point that I want to make is from the Doe versus McMillan case, which is the case that in the brief, the appellants rely on so heavily as a BLS analogy, because it involves an inquiry into whether the public printer is covered by the privilege and the superintendent of documents is covered by the privilege in the United States Supreme Court, the federal constitution. In the primary decision, the Supreme Court decided that whether the privilege, that they did not rule that the privilege did or did not automatically extend to the public printer or their superintendent of documents. It was a fact-specific inquiry. And on remand, based on the fact that the legislative committee ordered the printing of the documents, sent it to the public printer to print and distribute, and it was done at the direction of a committee covered by the privilege, that privilege then extended to the public printer. It was an immunity case. And that is a very, very important consideration that I overlooked mentioning earlier at one of the disadvantages of not using notes. You don't remember everything. But a lot of the cases that are relied on here are immunity cases. And there's a powerful incentive to grant immunity within the framework of this privilege, because that really does, as those of us who've been in the legislature know, that could be pretty intimidating. But discovery in a lawsuit is an entirely different framework and an entirely different analysis. So even though I've got a couple of minutes left, I think I have said all that I intended to say when I got up here, so if there are no questions, I'll conclude my argument.
All right, thank you very much. Before the clock starts to run down again, have you decided how to use it?
Yes, Your Honor, I will get the remainder.
Pardon?
I will get the remainder.
All right, you have 5 minutes and 27 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to give you a good example of why what the appellees are arguing here essentially undermines the scope of the privilege. The way that they are construing the privilege essentially would lead the legislatures to the following choice. I can either, one, carry around a whole bunch of pennies in my pocket that are drawn from the particular bank account that the court said is the one that protects people under legislative privilege and hand out a bunch of pennies to everybody that I talk to, or I could only talk to people about legislation who bring in their W-2 that has the particular state budget line item into my office with the door closed to talk about legislation. That's not the point of what the legislature is supposed to do. The purpose of the speech or debate clause is to protect legislators in the operation of the legislative branch. Their job as legislators is to gather information, hear differing viewpoints, hear from constituents, hear from others, hear from everybody on all sides of the issue, and consider all the facts and circumstances when they're making their decision about what they're going to introduce and how they're going to vote on it. And what the appellees are suggesting here undermines their ability to engage in that precise legislative function.
Now, is it your position that legislative services, for example, has an independent application of the privilege such that they could assert it when a member waived it?
Your Honor, I think if a member waives their privilege, that the DLS is probably outside of the scope of a privilege.
Well, now, if that's the case, then what Mr. Durrett said would be correct, that the privilege still resides with a member, and all of our discussions after that go to the scope of the privilege, not the assertion of the privilege.
Well, Your Honor, I think I would point you to the other circuit court case from Virginia that directly conflicts with the lower court here, and that's Mills v. Shelton. In that case, the court found in a defamation action that a letter that someone wrote to the Division of Legislative Services, that a citizen wrote to the Senate Courts of Justice Committee about a judicial candidate was absolutely privileged. And I actually think, I think now that I rethink this, I think I disagree with what Mr. Durrett argued here a minute ago. If I write legislation and give it to my legislator, I think that the act of giving that legislation to the legislator is just as protected as the individual who wrote the letter to the Courts of Justice Committee, and the court found it to be absolutely privileged. So,
but who has the privilege? In your example,
I think the privilege turns on what the act is. If the act is fundamental to the legislative process,
but who has it?
I think it's the actor.
Who has it?
The actor.
Does DLS have it, or does a member have it?
Well, when DLS is acting in its legislative function, it is taking direction from members about what to do. It is advising members on what they might do, how they might phrase amendments or how they might phrase legislation to accomplish their purpose. I think that they are acting in a legislative function, and therefore they are the actor protected. So I actually think I revise my comment from earlier.
Before you leave that point, let me make sure I heard the last thing correctly. Were you saying that under your theory of the case, a constituent's letter to a legislator, unsolicited, reflecting none of the prior communications between the constituent and the legislator, would be covered by the speech and debate clause?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's consistent with what the circuit court in Mills v. Shelton did.
With great respect to that one court, are there any other authorities for such a broad interpretation?
The notion of informal information gathering in the legislative process being protected has been upheld in the Fourth Circuit, in the Third Circuit, in the D.C. Circuit, and in the Ninth Circuit. Also protected.
And those are unsolicited letters from constituents and citizens to legislators?
Those cases all involve various degrees of informal information gathering in the legislative process by the legislators. I don't even think the cases got into whether someone reached out to the legislator first or whether the legislator affirmatively reached out to the constituent, because I think that under my formulation of the speech or debate clause, who originated the communication isn't actually a relevant question.
The problem is, in your formulation, I'm still grasping for a limiting principle, and I can't put my hands on it.
If it's fundamental to the legislative process, if you're calling your legislator to advise them on what you think about legislation, you get to have that privileged communication with your legislator. If it's outside the legislative function,
the constituent holds this privilege.
That's what the court found in Mills v. Shelton, and I think, Your Honor, but on the other hand, if you called your legislator and said, I think if you do this, it's, you know, or I think you should do the following to make sure you're reelected, you know, that's not a legislative discussion, that's a political discussion. But I think if you're calling a legislator and having a legislative discussion, that discussion is protected. I have about 30 seconds left.
Suppose the constituent and the legislator disagree. And you say the constituent holds a privilege.
Yes.
Can the legislator waive the constituent's privilege?
I think if two holders of a privilege communicate, I think the general rule in the general privilege context is that either party can waive that privilege.
I'm asking the obverse of that, if you will. Having waived it, does the other party who holds it as well have the right to stop its production?
I think they could intervene to try to prevent production, yes. And with that, I see I have about 6 seconds left.
Go right ahead.
Counsel, about 45 seconds ago, I started to smile broadly, recalling someone who has the same name as I do, who once served in the legislature. I don't recall a constituent ever calling me up and saying, you know, if you do such and such, it will help or hurt your reelection. Outside of a legislative discussion, I can think of plenty of people who called and said, vote my way and you will get reelected, or don't vote my way and you won't get reelected. They were, my phone logs were replete with such calls. Under those real world circumstances, is that privileged?
I think it is, Your Honor, when it's in the context of legislation, because if you don't protect it in that sense, then you get into judicial line drawing about what's protected and what isn't, even when it relates to the core legislative function. As long as it relates to a core legislative function, the speech or debate clause protects it.
Okay. Good answer to my question.
Thank you.
All right. Now, your time has expired, but we actually took a good bit of it. Why don't you just wrap up, all right?
Sure. My last three very quick points. One, with the question about employment, I point you to the remand in the Doe case. In that case, if you look at Judge Skelly Wright's opinion, he notes that some of the people whose communications there were protected included a D.C. police officer who was on loan to the House of Representatives and another consultant whose employment status they never address. So I think that's critical. Those two individuals were found by the Supreme Court to be covered by legislative privilege. Bethune-Hill and Page, Mr. Durrett suggested that those cases were decided under the speech or debate clause. I believe that Judge Payne in both of those cases expressly said he was deciding them under common law and not under speech or debate clause. And finally, with respect to your question, Mr. Justice, about the scope of the subpoenas, I point you to the Mimpeco decision from the D.C. Circuit from 1998 and the Tenney decision from the Supreme Court in 1951, where the court quashed overly broad subpoenas, even though there may have been a way to craft more narrowly that would have gotten to information that wasn't privileged. The court said these are too broad and therefore quashed them and didn't send them back for revision.
All right. Thank you very much. Counsel, thank you for your arguments. The court is adjourned.